Well, good afternoon. My name is Charles Marsh, and I'm a professor in the Religious Studies Department here at the university and director of the Project on Lived Theology. I welcome all of you to Jefferson Hall on this cool afternoon in September. It is my great pleasure to see such a large audience coming out for this rare opportunity to hear and learn lessons from Paul M. Gaston on the civil rights movement in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Paul, we are honored by your presence, and I am so grateful that you said yes to my invitation to come and share your story and your insights. Just a couple of words of introduction and clarification. The core audience of this afternoon's session is my civil rights seminar. There are 18 students in that seminar, so you see, once word got out that Professor Gaston was gracing us with his presence, how many people outside that class wanted to be a part of this. Professor Gaston is known to many of you, most of you, as a distinguished professor of history, an accomplished author. Indeed, Professor Gaston joined the history department here at UVA in 1957 and taught for four decades until his retirement in 1997, teaching in the field of Southern history and civil rights studies. Many of you know him as a man who engaged the challenges and the struggles of the civil rights years in Charlottesville and at the university with conviction and courage and a gentlemanly demeanor. Paul M. Gaston was born in Fairhope, Alabama, a fascinating utopian community founded by his grandfather on the principles of justice and equality. And Professor Gaston has written several fascinating books on this remarkable single tax colony along the Gulf Coast. Man and Mission, E.B. Gaston and the Origins of the Fairhope Single Tax Colony, Women of Fairhope, and most recently, this beautiful, moving, highly recommended memoir, Coming of Age in Utopia, so well done by New South Books of Montgomery, The Odyssey of an Idea, which I read in one spellbound week in the summer, and would love for all of you to have and to give as presents and, you know, bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and Christmas presents and birthdays and get the word out. Among his numerous moral and intellectual accomplishments, one must take note of his leadership in the Southern Regional Council, his tireless and often costly support of local integration efforts, and his participation and coordination in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s one and only visit to the University of Virginia in, was it March of 1963, speaking to a citywide rally in Memorial Gym. Professor Gaston has been the recipient of many awards for his civil service, the 2008 Legendary Civil Rights Activist Award given by the NAACP. In 2005, he was awarded the Bridge Builders Award by the City of Charlottesville. In 2004, he received the Brown versus Board of Education Recognition Award. In 2001, the Virginia Foundation of the Humanities, Outstanding Faculty Award, State Council of Higher Education in the state of Virginia, and in 1970, the Lillian Smith Award for his landmark book, The New South Creed, that Knopf published in 1970. We are thrilled to have you here. And finally, Paul, before you share with us your story, I I want to acknowledge the debt I owe you as a fellow Southerner and fellow Alabamian, born just up the road in Mobile from Fairhope, for your courageous and luminous career. As I have made my own journey from a childhood along the Gulf Coast to this academical village, all that you have written and taught, and the way you have lived, and the grace with which you speak against the day, have inspired my own humble efforts to pursue this strange career of the engaged scholar, and for that I am grateful, and again, thank you very much for accepting our invitation this afternoon. We look forward to our time together. Thank you.
Wow. I guess quid pro quo exists. I had a call from, I think it was Mel Leffler, who was dean at the time, and he said the religion department is considering to make a major appointment to a young man named Charles Marsh, or Charles Robert Marsh, I believe it is. And he's written a book on civil rights, and would you look at it and see if we ought to make that appointment? And I said, well, where is he now? Well, he's sitting around here somewhere. So I said, well, I've already read a book of his, and I know about him, and I think you'd be making a serious mistake if you did not get him hired right away. So there he is, up there making all these remarks about me. I'm sure they're all true. So. Martin King came spoke at Harrison place where that. No, he spoke. You're right. He spoke at the auditorium when we had him here to speak. He was at Cabo Hall, but he spoke later. The group spoke that was about him. Well, look, this is a talk. As Charles says, about the my understanding of the civil rights movement in Charlottesville. What I've decided to do to sort of cut it down to something I know about is to talk to you about how social change comes about. Now, that's a huge subject with places, there's all sorts of things we could talk about. The civil rights movement, for example, the big civil rights movement that was responsible for the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. If it hadn't been for the Civil Rights Act, who knows? If it hadn't been for the civil rights movement, who knows when those acts would have been passed? My experience is with two examples of how change came about as a consequence of protest from below. When I came to the University of Virginia in 1957, I thought all sorts of great changes would be made because here was a place of learning. I mean, you had rational debate, you had civility, you had evidence. And that was all it should take in order to change the world. Well, it turned out I was wrong. Shortly after I arrived, well, let me interrupt myself here to say that I'm going to talk about the university as an example of my thesis first, and then I want to talk about how segregation was ended in the cities. One of the first things I was given when I came here was a letter, was an article about a man named Paul Barringer. If you've been over to the hospital, you may have been in the Barringer wing. Well, it was named after Dr. Barringer. He was the chairman of the faculty in the late 19th and early 20th century. That position was abolished in 1904 when the first president of the university was appointed. Mr. Barringer had this to say about the population in the world that had never been allowed to study or to teach on the grounds of the university. No longer slaves, blacks were now on the road to barbarism, he wrote. It's as natural as the return of the sow that is washed to her wallowing in the mire. He believed blacks lacked all of the civilized characteristics valued by white people. Comfort, health, self-respect, and gentility, he wrote, are as a rule nothing compared with the gratification of vanity, lust, the craving for drink, tobacco, the gaming habit, etc. Supply a black man's bodily wants, including a woman, he wrote, and he is happy under any social conditions. Well, as a man who was the head of the university that I'd come to, hoping to have a wonderful chance to change things, I almost left when I read this, but then somebody said, well, that's a long time ago. And I thought that if I was going to be involved in civil rights activities, Virginia was probably a very good place to be, because, as I learned from Barringer and Wood from subsequent other encounters in the university, Virginia was very much like the Deep South in that its values and customary beliefs were like those of the Deep South. The difference was that you didn't get beaten up for expressing your opposition to all of that, whereas in the Deep South, my home state of Alabama, your home state of Alabama, or Mississippi, you'd be in serious trouble if you took a stand in opposition to white supremacy. You'd get fired if you taught in a university. You'd get beaten up if you were a sit-in. It did turn out later that you could get beaten up here, but not too badly. No, that's true. I had a bandage across my face, and people thought that was pretty cool. Well, folks didn't use that term back then. Well, Barringer's speech, the point of view he expressed, faded in time. People didn't use the same language. But much of the consequence of what he believed, a belief that was inherited by many people around here, indicated to me that this was really a place to work. And I'd like to talk about who did that work and what they accomplished. By the time I got here in 1957, Colgate Darden was president, and he was a lovable, we all thought, honorable man, but he was distant from Barringer by a long shot. But you know, there were some similarities. The massive resistance legislation, which all of you know about, which said that black folk were not going to be able to go to schools where white folk were. Darden was in favor of that. He had spoken in the Prince Edward case in favor of it. He thought that the blacks and whites shouldn't be going to school together. He did say one time that that segregation has been used time after time as a shield for discrimination and oppression. He believed that, but he never wanted to speak out against segregation. Now, I don't know why. I didn't know President Darden well enough to ask him why he didn't take his belief and put his belief into action, what he knew about segregation. But I think he was trapped by his heritage. And there was no way that he felt he could escape it. He did wonderful things for the university, but much was left to be done. Now, nobody in positions of authority in the university when I came in 1957 used the language that Barringer had used. That was pretty well gone. But we were a long way from making this a university, a biracial university, all the way up, from the people who worked for it, from the people who taught in it, from the people who studied in it. And that seemed to me a goal that ought to be pursued. And it was. And I was really lucky that I got to know the students who brought about the change. And they were from the bottom up, you might say. They were a wonderful group, and they changed this university. A few examples. It was in the early 60s. I'm a historian, so I don't remember dates and names. In the early 60s, a black student named Virginia Thornton. Virginia was a graduate student in the history department, and he was one of the first blacks. Well, he was the first black to be admitted as a graduate student in history. Virginia was already a member of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he decided that he was going to have some activity here. So he went down to the University Theater. Some of you may have heard of it. I doubt that very many of you ever went to the movies there. It was down at the corner. It's no longer there. It did not have a policy of segregation. It had a policy of exclusion. It had no balcony. And you can't have segregation without a balcony, because the black people and the white people can't sit in the same part. Virginia's led us in an action against that. And several people went down, and they tried to buy tickets, and the white people got tickets, and the black people didn't. And Virginia said we ought to start a boycott of the University Theater, and that we ought to picket. And a lot of students went down to picket. Now I want to introduce another aspect of this problem. I've told you about what Barringer said and what President Darden said. Wes Harris was one of the students who did some picketing down in front of the University Theater. Some of you may, if any of you saw the program we had with Wes and me and Julian Bond when we talked about the time that Dr. King had been here, then you know who Wes Harris, you know something about Wes Harris. Wes was a first-year student in the engineering school. And he was picketing along with others down at the University Theater. And he tells the story of how some white students threw coins down at his feet and said, "Pick those up, nigger." Now, this man, who turns out to be one of the greatest graduates of this university, most recently he was a head of some kind of department I couldn't understand at MIT. He's been an advisor to NASA. He's a brilliant man. I have a hard time staying on the subject, so I've just thought something about Wes I want to say because we're in this room. Student in engineering, black. One of his teachers said, Wes, you've made a lot of accomplishments here, but you got to crack the big time where they think they're so important. And he said, what you want me to do? Well, you should become a member of the Jefferson Society. Oh, how'd I do that? So they told him. And he became a member of the Jefferson Society. And he made his probationary speech here in this room. The subject was Kierkegaard and existentialism. And that should have just knocked for a loop a whole bunch of stereotypes. And eventually it did. Wes would become the second black person appointed to the faculty of the university after he got a PhD at Princeton. It took him a whole 4 years to do that. Anyway, he's a great friend of mine and a great man. I'm sorry we didn't manage to keep him. But I think of him when I come to this room. Okay, so this was an example of how those who were going to protest for change were going to meet difficulties. And I could, and the students were beginning to move. Let me give one more example of student building a student movement and then the difficulties that some of them ran into. Shortly after the theater boycott failed and to make a difference in the theater, the students decided to form an organization to bring about change. It would be the first of several that they formed. And it was called the Virginia Council on... It was a branch of the Virginia Council on Human Relations. The student branch, and appropriately called the Jefferson branch of the Council on Human Relations. The Council on Human Relations was established by the Southern Regional Council, and it had branches all through the South. Its major aim was to create an atmosphere favorable to desegregation, and in general, an anti-racist, decent culture. So we established, or the students established, a branch here. They couldn't get it working right away because in those days, if students can tell me, I'm sure it's the same now. In those days, you couldn't be a university organization and have, you know, the use of offices and buildings to have events in, unless the student council approves. Is that the same? Yeah, you're all shaking it. Well, I'm sorry, it's the same. the members of the student council in those days of the early 1960s said, are you worthy of being an organization of the University of Virginia? What do? You probably would have members of the NAACP down here. And one of the editors of the Cavalier Daily had recently written in an editorial that the NAACP was a well-known Communist Front organization. Any Virginia-approved organization ought to be involved in demonstrating against the Brown decision that called for integration of schools. And the student council shared those views. So it said, this Virginia Council on Human Relations group could not be approved because they were afraid, they didn't say it right out, but they were afraid that it would bring in people from the NAACP and they'd have sit-ins and picketing. You can't have that sort of thing at a place like this. Until a friend of mine, Tom Hammond, who taught Russian history, and Tom and I were the advisors to this not-yet-approved group. Tom got up at one of their meetings and he said, you know, I teach Russian history. And what you all are doing here by not allowing this organization to exist sure reminds me of some of the things I teach about the Soviet Union. And you really don't want to have a reputation like that, do you? Well, they said they did. But they worked out a compromise. Some of the students went in who were in the protest group went in the hallway, changed their rules. What do you call it all of a sudden? I can't think. Not the Constitution, bylaws. And said that this organization would have no sit-ins and no major protests. And with that, they were approved. So that became the first major student organization. Wes was a member of it, and I could name a dozen other young students who became a member of this organization. What did they do after that? What they did was to continue pressuring the administration. Having speeches in front of the rotunda, writing all kinds of protest documents outlining what the university ought to be like. Integration of the races in both the student body and the faculty, those were the central issues which they focused on. Each year, the cadre of protesting students was enlarged. And I think it was enlarged because there were students who in high school had been watching television, and they'd been watching the white Southerners and some white Northerners too express with crowbars, burnings, everything horrible about the nature of the opposition to integration. And they began to think at home, this isn't right. Something ought to be done about it. They wanted to be educated, so they came here. And they were a marvelous group. You know, there were about 10 of them in the mid-60s. And so they were very much a minority in the university. But they were going to change the university. They weren't going to let happen the things that, for example, will happen to Wes Harris. Wes tells a story about how he went to the dormitory that he was assigned to live in, and it was a nice room, and he had a roommate. Roommate was a different color from him, very sort of white boy like me. And the white boy left. He wasn't going to be in a room. So Wes says, well, I had two desks and two beds and a lot of space. I could get a lot of good work done here. He didn't. And then others like John like was in John. I can't call up their names all of a sudden. I'm sorry. Roger Hickey. And Roger right now is the head of a very progressive, impressive, effective, influential group in Washington now. But then, when he came into his dorm room, he pasted on the door a picture of Martin King. And somebody living on his floor came and scratched it out and added three letters, K, 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 to it. And Roger got to be known, and they called him this day after day as the nigger lover on the floor. I use these awful terms because these are the terms that were used by the gentlemen of Virginia. And these young students who were not going to have this carry on had to live with that. David Nolan came as a firebrand. He was talking about when... prominent black leaders had been murdered, and he was really ready to fight, to do something, and he showed to his roommate a picture of blacks in a demonstration in Danville, and this boy was from Danville, his roommate, being beaten and their heads being beaten open. And this boy, I don't know what you can make out of this. Where did this come from? Family values? Was something he really believed. He said to David, "Oh, that's all right. Niggers like that." Well, David changed rooms. But he was going to do a lot more before all of this was over. But it was things like this that didn't discourage them. It encouraged them to keep working. And after a while, it was not just to bring more black students to the university, get black professors, but it was to change the reputation of the University of Virginia. Now, that was something that the majority of students who were racist, for the most part, didn't like, because to them, the critical point was the reputation of the University of Virginia. And when students went around sitting in or boycotting the university theater, that tarnished the reputation of the university, and that was a cardinal sin. All of this was now changing. But it took a long time. Now I'm going to give one more. I don't want to talk too long because we've got to get to another subject. I'll wind up very quickly on this. In 1965, there had been beatings on the Pettus Bridge that went out of Selma, and you all, many of you will know about the protests in Selma, where black folks were going to register to vote. And as a consequence, two of them were shot and killed. Others were beaten. And when they decided to have a march and some across the Pettus Bridge, whom did they meet at the other end but friendly George Wallace? Remember our friend George Wallace? With his troopers there. And those folks were not going to have a march from Selma to Montgomery. Wallace's troopers were going to beat them up so they'd know this was not the place that they should be. Eventually, there was a march. The students here, my group of revolutionaries, decided that they would like to have what they called a Sympathy for Selma demonstration with speeches at the rotunda and comments about how we were going to support the Selma people who wanted to vote. I was asked by the students who organized this group and the meeting if I would write a letter. If I would write a letter to my colleagues urging them to come to this meeting. So I did. All I said was, the students who are having this Sympathy for Selma march would appreciate your presence, period, something like that, and when it would take place, where it would be. And so a big crowd arrived. And it was pretty clear that the administration wasn't too happy about what we was going to be saying. Tom Gardner, one of the students, had gone to Selma and had marched at the end of the march from Pettus Bridge to Montgomery. And he held up a banner with a Jefferson quote on it, something about all eyes are looking toward freedom or something. And it said, University of Virginia. Well, when he got back, this piece had gotten in on the news, and one of the deans had read it, and he called Tom in the office. He said, "Tom, I'm very sorry, but you cannot do things like this. You cannot associate the University of Virginia with things like what happened in Selma. You must not do that." So it gave you an impression of where the administration stood. I got a reprimand, a mild reprimand, it didn't amount to much, for having written a letter. The president, through channels to the chairman of the department, to the dean of the college, to the chairman of the department, to me, saying that in future he hoped I would act with more discretion. Well, I've been discreet most of the time. Anyway, that gives you a sense of what the powers that be felt about bringing change, even the right to vote in Selma, how they felt. Not everybody was that way. We had just recruited a man to come here as the Jefferson Foundation Professor of History. His name was Merrill Peterson, and he'd only been here 2 or 3 years. But we asked him to take part in the Selma Sympathy for Selma demonstration, and he did. And I'm going to read you just a bit of what he said. "This university, dedicated by its father to the illimitable freedom of the human spirit, bears a high responsibility for the cause of free men everywhere, above all to the Selmas of our beloved country. No university," he said, "has a clearer title to speak for that heritage in the present crisis than the University of Virginia. And it is high time, long past time, we were heard from. Unlike Tom and me, no one in authority criticized Merrill. He was too important. On the other hand, no one in authority said to him in private, "Yes, we agree with what you said." They said nothing to him. They just ignored him. So he wasn't going to be touched. But he had the right idea, and this advanced the cause of the rebels. Now, as time went by, more students who came to the university, those high school students who, as I said, had been watching the news about what the civil rights movement had meant, more and more students came and joined the Council on Human Relations, and then created a new group, Students for Social Action. It was called SSA, and the editor of the Cavalier Daily wrote an editorial saying we ought to reverse their acronym. It was SSA, and we ought to change the letters around to ASS. And that's why that's a kind of gentlemanly decorum that still existed. We're now at the middle of the 60s, and this is still going on. They were really treated in a bad way. West continued to have cigarettes thrown at his feet when he was walking across the grounds, lit cigarettes thrown at his feet. Well, by 1968, which is what I call the year of the revolution, in 1968, major change finally came. The students formed a group they called, I can't now remember what they did call it. Anyway, it was wasn't the student forum. That's awful, I'm sorry. But it was a group that involved, and this was one of the major reasons it was going to be successful, the Interfraternity Council. That was a big step forward, that they were going to support it. The Student Council, most of the major influential student organizations in the university by 1968 had come over to the side of the rebels. What did that mean? They wanted a course in black studies. They wanted recruitment of black faculty. They wanted to appoint an assistant dean whose job it would be to recruit black students to come to the university. All these groups, Student Council, Interfraternity Council, Students for Social Action, and two or three others that had been created, drew up the plan, the program, to put all these things into effect, took them to President Shannon, and said, "You need to do this." I will shorten this just a little bit. He was reluctant to appoint a dean, even an assistant dean, just because of his color. He thought that would be discrimination. He was in favor of recruiting black athletes, but anyway, by the end of the year, 68-69, these students, and by this time a number of black students had come to the university, and some of them had founded a very influential group called the Black Students for Freedom, the BSF. And they had been very active working with the major group that had started. The president agreed before the end of 69 that these changes would be discussed in a committee he was going to form. Now, usually when you don't want to do something, you appoint a committee. And in a way, I guess you could say that President Shannon was caught in that trap because the committee didn't make a report till the end of August, and by that time, everything had been put in place. Anyway, the students, and this is an interpretation of mine, and it may be wrong, but I feel that the students liberated Edgar Shannon. I think earlier he would have liked to have seen black students come and black professors, but he didn't want to buck his board of visitors and others who didn't want to do this. This is my interpretation. But he was the kind of person who, by 1970, became a major progressive leader, urging the students to get up and protest the war in Vietnam, sending students and to go talk to Virginia senators and say, Edgar Shannon sent me. He became a great hero, and deservedly so. And I remember a time he, at a garden party a few years later, he walked over to me and said, Paul, when's the history department going to get off the dime and appoint some black faculty members? And I said, Edgar, just as soon as you start coming over here and telling us that. And he said, well, I'll come over and do that. And he did. And I think we did. Did we? I knew it was a success because in August we had a new dean. His name was David Shannon. And he called me into his office and he said, Paul, there are a few things I would like you to do. He said, I have read all of the things that happened in this previous year. And I know you're very proud of the students who did this, and I am too. And this is what I would like you to do. And I said, okay, I'm listening. He said, I'd like you to teach a course in black studies. Oh, I said, okay, but I need some money. I'm not going to be the white boy who all by himself gets up and tell you what black folks are like. And so I want money so I could bring black professors here to lecture. And he said, oh, yeah, just tell me how much you want and you'll get it. That's, you know, things have changed. He said, also, I'd like you to chair a committee to design a program, an interdisciplinary program, an interdisciplinary major in black studies. Okay. And then he said, I want you to form another committee and search for and appoint a distinguished black scholar to take care of the place, to take over the leadership of the black studies program and all of its aspects. I said, okay, well, we'll do that. So we did, and appointed a man named Joseph Washington, who was a distinguished religious scholar. Then he came and stayed for a few years. So summing up, in my judgment, the story of the University of Virginia in these years, even with echoes also with echoes of Mr. Barringer back in the late 19th century. The story of those years is that a culture of white supremacy was confronted by a group of students, a goodly number of them, white students. But there weren't that many students to bring about a revolution in 1 year. It took them 10 years of movement building, of solidarity and persuasion and persistence to change the University of Virginia. And it happened. If any of you would like to support a motion I have in my head, but have only suggested to President Sullivan without getting the reply that I wanted, I think we ought to bring back about 10 or 12 students who are active in this and honor them in some way. So I hope to get something discussed sometime about that. Well, I had planned to talk about how segregation ended in Charlottesville as the second, but that might take up a lot of time. I don't know. Would you all like to ask questions about what I said about the university or what I didn't say that you know about in these years? Yeah.
Infant mortality is kind of the canary in the coal mine of public health. Yeah. And even today, in the white population in Charlottesville, the infant mortality rate is about 5 babies per 1,000. But in the African-American population, it's 20.2. So we have 4 times the infant mortality rate here in Charlottesville. So I think we still have work to do. I would say that segregation has not ended.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And what happened in 68-69 helped the university turn a corner. It didn't revolutionize it. And there are lots of students and lots of professors and lots of observers like you who realize the problems in the university that have to be confronted. I'm not here anymore. I'm retarded. And so I don't know, but I hear it every time I talk to someone. So there's still much to do.
Do you think it could have gone faster if there had been different leadership in you know, the late 50s or early 60s, or do you really think it was going to take that much time for the student body to actually come around to it as well as the leadership?
I thought it was going to be a long and worthwhile fight. And I got to know the student protesters and Howard Romaine, and they were a marvelous group of people. I learned from them. Two of them, they got married, Howard Romaine and Ann Cook. They got a house out in the country, and they invited all of their fellow radicals there frequently. And I would go, and I could make noise when I sang along with them, but I was very silent when I listened to them. And when I listened to them, I thought this has got to be a success. They've got to be able to change the university. They care about the university. I mean, they weren't, you know, negative about the university. They were negative about its practice of white supremacy, but not about the possibilities and the grandeur that it represented. So, yeah, I was optimistic all along. And I was about President Shannon. He got after me a couple of times, but he might, why not? And I thought he had the heart of a man who wanted to change things. And it turned out that was right. But it took a while to get to that point. Does that answer the question? I mean, yeah.
Have you published on the topic of the history of civil rights at the university specifically?
Yeah. I meant to bring it with me, but I couldn't find it. I wrote a pamphlet, which I think I sent to the library, but maybe not, called Government by Demonstration. And that term came about when the rector of the university was approached by an alumnus of the university who was really, really upset when he learned that I had written a letter urging people to come to the Sympathy for Selma demonstration. And the rector replied to this outraged alumnus that he objected to that too, and he did not believe in government by demonstration. And I thought, well, that's good. So I wrote a pamphlet. I wrote a pamphlet called Government by Demonstration. And I didn't want to... that pamphlet's around here somewhere. I've got one copy of it in manuscript. If everybody wants it, I'd be glad to get rid of it. It's in my...
I was going to say, that's a great question, thank you, that we have some... we made some copies of your writings on UVA in the 60s and the civil rights movement here that we put on our course website. I am happy with Mr. Gaston's approval to put those on our civil rights website, and in any case, to send you copies of those if you email me. They're really excellent, including the pamphlet when Martin Luther King came to Charlottesville. They're also, to plug this book again, at least three chapters in this book on UVA in the 50s and 60s.
Over there, Kelly. Just a quick question. I'm sure others know the answer to this. The first African American student at UVA, was that about the time that you came? I'm over here. About the time that you came, and was that because of court action that ended the policy of discrimination? Because I met a man in the I'm from the community, and I met a man in the community who was denied admission here because of his race. And I wondered what year that was, the first student came, and what precipitated the change.
I was looking the wrong way, looking for you. Well, in 1935, a woman from Richmond applied to go to graduate school, and she was told that they could not admit her because that would be to break the long tradition of the University of Virginia, as though that was a surprise to her. Then the next person who came was Gregory Swanson, who applied to law school, and that was about 10 years later. And he, I think, went to court for this and was successful in being admitted. And the administration attempted to make this be a, to limit the precedent to the law school. And it didn't, I don't know how they tried, but 10 years later, there were hardly any black students. So Swanson's admission didn't really change very much, although it's very important that he came. I think that I didn't get the last part of your question.
When was the first undergraduate African-American student, and was that through legal action or change in policy at the university?
Well, the first one in the college. The college became a bastion for white boys because even after Gregory Swanson was admitted and a few others in the education school, the college remained all white. And then Paul Sonier, who's an advisor to the president, I think I chatted with Paul one day and got the feeling that they wanted to stop the criticism of the university for being so white. So Paul got in touch with an undergraduate, black undergraduate, in the engineering. I think it was he was an engineer, yeah. And Paul got him transferred to the college for the next semester. So the change came at the second semester, and he became the first African-American in the College of Arts and Sciences. And that was a move designed to keep the press from stop complaining about segregation in the university. But I think engineering became a major source of important students. And what's the rest? Did I?
That was good.
I've answered it. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi. I'm so glad you're here. In one of your articles, or maybe pamphlet that we read for class, you mentioned something about the honor code and how it kind of maintained the gentlemanly conduct at the university and also, like, white supremacy in some ways. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit about, like, the honor code and white supremacy.
Well, one of the protesting students once said that when he was arguing with the traditional students that they believed that the two essential ingredients of the University of Virginia's character were the honor code and wearing coats and ties. Now, I don't know, that doesn't answer your question, but, yeah, those were very important. And I don't think the protesters had any objection to the honor code. They never opposed that. And they didn't object to coats and ties, but they walked around in blue jeans and beards and all kinds of things, and they got criticized by Cavalier Daily for that. But I think coats and ties and the honor code is a good subject for study. You probably have some ideas. Why don't you express them? I see a hand in the way back.
How, as members of the UVA community, particularly those who teach students, what can the university do to help students understand this history better so that it doesn't promulgate in the future? Is there something that we could offer first years and first year graduate students so that they're aware of the history, so that it can be incorporated and discussed in an educational setting?
Yeah. I tried once. I had a small undergraduate seminar on the civil rights movement in Charlottesville, and I invited Eugene Williams to come, Eugene is sort of Mr. Civil Rights in this town. And he came, and after about 5 minutes, he started telling the students, well, now you need to go down to this store. They're discriminating against black people, and they need to be pressured. And I think the best thing your students can do is go down there. And I said, Eugene, I invited you here to talk about history. We're supposed to do it. And he said, well, I'm sure you've taken care of that, but this is what you people need to be doing. And he would tell you what needs to be done left today. And Eugene is still doing that, except he's not well now. I'm sorry about that. But he's a name to conjure with. You know him, Sally?
On the subject of the history of blacks and African Americans at the University of Virginia, to get back to your question, Claudrina Harold, professor in the history department, has just designed a new course called Black Fire.
Yeah, great.
And it's about precisely that subject, and it just got approved by pretty much today by Mark Hadley here and myself, who work for CEPC, the curriculum. What's it called? Educational Policy and
Right.
So this is going to be a great new course that I'm sure lots of people will want to take.
What's the course called?
Black Fire.
When will it be offered? Next fall.
Oh.
She also talks about it in her intro to African American Studies Part 2, 1020, AS 1020.
Well, just because fall started yesterday, it's not that doesn't mean it's going to be now, does it?
Mm-hmm. Next year.
Okay. Well, that's great.
As an experimental course.
Yeah. Great. I wish I weren't retarded.
Thank you so much for the talk. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the way, just because of the course that we're taking this semester, religion played into these conversations. I think you mentioned that the first person to take over for a more directed African-American studies program was a religionist. So could you talk about the way that religion played into these conversations and also demonstration, et cetera?
What was were you mentioning Joseph Washington? That's what you meant, the first person to take over was a religious scholar.
Sure, yeah.
I didn't understand you, could.
So that, and also for the students that you were meeting with, if there were particular conversations about religion and communities, I don't know if there were churches that also became involved in some of these demonstrations and marches?
I don't think that was a major motivating source for the students that I knew who were involved in working for change. I don't. And maybe because I myself didn't have that orientation. I just wanted them to break down the barriers. And they did. Well, I'm going to interrupt and say I have a question.
May I ask one quick question, if you don't mind, dear sir?
You're senior to me.
No, it's it may be more a lament than a question. Because when I read your book this summer and your writings on that those years at Virginia, while I was exhilarated by the breakthrough and the change that you and your comrades brought to this place, there were aspects of the story that almost made it sound like that the breakthrough was also the golden year, the golden years of UVA, and particularly if you indulge me a moment on this matter of hiring black faculty members. When I was hired in 1999, and thank you for helping me get on through Mel Leffler's stack of papers. There were no tenured African Americans in my department, and I was delighted, having done my graduate work here in the 80s, to learn that coming with me in the fall of 2000, where an African-American, Wallace Best, who does African-American religious history, and a young Latino scholar who had both accepted these offers. So Wallace came, and the Latino scholar decided, I can't remember his name, I never met him, but he took a position at the University of Southern California and bowed out of the UVA job. So that was the first line. There was one line. Wallace left 3 or 4 years later for a job at Harvard, and now he's at Princeton. Mm-hmm. Good friends of many of us in the program. Mm-hmm. But he's no longer among us. Mm-hmm. The waiting line for his classes was around the block. Mm-hmm. He was a dynamic, brilliant scholar. Mm-hmm. We also hired a second line, Corey Walker. Some of you may remember Corey, who did sort of African-American studies and race theory. Mm-hmm. About 2003, 2004, he was here for 3 or 4 years and took a job at Brown, where he directed the Center for Africana Studies there. But that was a second line. That was actually not Wallace's line. So these are two lines in African-American two lines in the Religious Studies Department for African-American scholars. We also had a brilliant Africanist named Isabella Mukunura, who was just delightful, brilliant scholar of African religions with some secondary interest in American religious history, mm-hmm. This is the third line. She left to take a position at Western Kentucky because we couldn't get a tenure-track offer together for her. Mm-hmm. So these are three lines, three separate lines. Then we made a hire 2006, 2007. This was to replace Wallace Best, a woman named Valerie Cooper, who many of you know. She's one of my dearest friends. She's my neighbor down the bottom of Gibson Hall. We did a lot of work together. Valerie, in her office, had a photograph of herself as a 10-year-old girl, mm-hmm. wearing a University of Virginia jersey.
Oh, sweet.
Her father had been a janitor at UVA, and the years, of course, when she's wearing this UVA jersey, she could not have been a student at UVA. But she left last year for a job at Duke. Mm-hmm. So it's 2014, and we do not have an African-American tenured professor in my department. And, you know, we hear a lot of rhetorical kind of affirmation of the need to diversify the faculty. Yeah. But in the end, it's all equivocation and jive. And there's, in my 15 years here, never been a Board of Visitors decision or a clear mandate with money to make these hires at the department level. I don't know what we can do. So this is more a lament than a question.
Well, I agree with you, but B, I can tell you how something happened once that is kind of answered to your lament, but you've got to have the right way to make it come about, and that's difficult. When Armstead Robinson was recruited and came here, African-American scholar, a man who didn't mind saying, y'all do this, Armstead became friends with Ed Floyd, who was at that time the dean of the faculty. And Armstead persuaded the dean to give him five or six, I can't remember how many, but several lines. And he would recruit the people. And then he would come say to the religion, hey, I've got a man here that you ought to hire. I can give him to. Is that all right with you? Or he would go to the political science department. He would recruit a group of people and give them to departments. And I don't know, nothing has ever been done like that since. So I guess we have a new dean, but you can, if you can persuade a dean to do that, to say, or maybe just get a couple of you to, I don't know. Anyway, that worked very well.
And it would help if the students made some noise. And here we have Aaron.
Yeah.
That was a nice segue. Suppressing the PSA.
Political action chair. But that leads very well into a question that I wanted to ask, which has to do a lot with the culture and environment of the university. And so you spoke a lot about Wesley Harris and his role protesting, but also his role in the Jefferson Society. I'm one of, I think, maybe three regular members of the Jefferson Society now who still come to the hall regularly for meetings. And as you spoke about students throwing their lit cigarettes at Wesley Harris's feet as he walked around grounds, it's very reminiscent to me of the stories you hear from black students today when they're out near the fraternity houses or late at night when no one is around. And so you have people yelling out of cars the N-word or pointing to ropes in the backs of their pickup trucks. And I think that a large part of it is of why we, one, have seen decreasing black enrollment for students and also a very strong stagnation of black faculty and terrible black faculty retention has a lot to do with the culture of UVA and the fact that it doesn't particularly cultivate a desire to either come when students visit before accepting an offer or to stay once faculty get here. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder how we might go about changing that.
Oh, just have a modest revolution. I gave a head shaking. Don't have a modest revolution? Yes, do. I knew you were a revolutionary from way back, so what the? I don't know the answer to that question because what was it happened just recently?
The rally?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What was that about?
So we recently put together a rally against police brutality and media misrepresentation.
Yeah.
So sort of sparked by the most recent killings of unarmed black men, but really in response to a nationwide epidemic. And so we had probably a 200 to 300 person turnout for that on the lawn a few weeks ago.
Yes, I read about that and I wondered what sparked it then. Was it to go beyond police or focus exclusively on police?
So this rally went, excuse me, towards media misrepresentation as well, which I personally feel is a very large factor in, one, the way that police interact with black civilians, but also the way that white students interact with black students on grounds and faculty interact with black students at the university as well.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I admire Tim Long, the chief of police. What's your attitude?
Towards the chief of police?
Yeah.
I think that he's open to conversation. Yeah. So we'll see how open to implementing student ideas he is in the near future.
But wouldn't you say that in your experience over the years that it does take a little noise among the students and faculty as allies to inspire any kind of real institutional change. And I think students have the power, much more power than they recognize here, to push on these issues. I would say, and we'll get into this when we look at SNCC in a few weeks, but the genius of SNCC is its ability to, while having the vision of beloved community and the dream and all of that, to really concentrate on the two or three or four things that need to be changed in the here and now, the sort of commitment to piecemeal social reform. And so when there are opportunities among the student body, the BSA, for example, and when you have a moment when the newspapers are coming to you and the cameras are on you, too often in the past, if I may offer my, two cents worth, there has been a kind of response along these lines. Well, let's set forth, 10 ideals or 10 sort of demands that we would like to negotiate for in the process. And they're laudable demands, but they're kind of abstract, eliminating racism on grounds and so on and so forth. I mean, all that's good. But why not just focus on hiring black faculty? So that would be the strategic goal for 1 year. It gathers momentum. And by the end of the spring, there's a demonstration on the steps of the rotunda. And, everybody on the Board of Visitors is sick of hearing this group of students and faculty and community people and alums talking about the dearth of black faculty. So a specific, achievable change in hiring, institutional practice, and the like.
So, I guess, and you stole my thunder for actually next week, but black faculty is definitely one of our larger initiatives this year, and we've looked a lot into audacious, I believe it's audacious faith or audacious hope, and then audacious faith too, mm-hmm. which were written by the BSAs in the 90s and then again in the mid-2000s, and where a lot of their large focuses are changes specific to UVA. But I think what you said about whenever you create a committee, that's the quickest way to have an initiative die, but also act like it's like you're working towards it to sort of silence the noise. And so I wonder what the response can be to the committees, the numerous committees on increasing diversity, because they obviously haven't been working. In fact, have been sort of retroactive.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
She's going to take my place at
I don't know the answer to that. One of my colleagues. How are you?
I'm as well as you.
I can hardly walk. What are you talking about?
I can walk, but that's about it.
Great to see you. Take care.
Paul, do you see what your presence has done here today?
One of my favorite colleagues here. He's wonderful. Take his courses in Latin American history. He's great. He's also a revolutionary. That's good. I don't know. I like you, though. Keep it up. I have one question I would like to ask. My theme was how you bring about change. And the example was the University of Virginia, and we turned a corner. That was sort of summing up what my idea was I would do. But I also was going to talk about how segregation ended in the Charlottesville community. I had thought of telling you about how the man in my... Did I already say this about a man who...
Would you be so kind as to share a few thoughts about the Charlottesville story? Could we take a quick break now? Yeah. Some people have to move on.
Well, I was going to say, if you didn't have time, I was going to talk about, it would take about 20 minutes. But you may want to go.
No, we just need to take a break because we usually take a break at this point. And
okay.
Then we will those who can stay and don't have conflicts can gather around in a more intimate circle, perhaps, and hear your stories and your insights. We would be very grateful if you could share a few words about Charlottesville. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll reconvene in 3 or 4 minutes. So this is the true believers, the faithful among you, and we're grateful to you for staying around a bit longer, and love to hear whatever you want to share on the Charlottesville story.
Well, I have the second half of my speech, of talk, or trying to remember what I was going to say. And it would be shorter. I just thought it fits with the first part. One was dealt with the university, one dealt with the city. So I'll make this fairly short. But in 1963, we had a picnic at a law professor's home. And at the end, toward the end of the picnic, a man named Floyd Johnson, who was new to the city, he was a preacher in one of the black churches, and the new chair of the NAACP. He stood up on a box and called us up, and he said, "We're going to have a sit-in, Charlottesville needs that, and any of you who would like to come, be at my church X day, Y hour, I've forgotten all that." And I looked over, we were having a picnic at the end of the season of the Virginia Council on Human Relations in its attempt to integrate the facilities, the hotels, the motels, the restaurants, and all that. And we hadn't been very successful. Floyd asked us if we would do that. And so several of us did come, not everybody. Mary, my wife, and I, we came. And Floyd got up at one point, and he read a little from a pamphlet telling women and men what they should do when they are assaulted. And I looked at Mary and I said, "Hell, this is Charlottesville, Virginia. This is not Mississippi. Nobody's going to beat us up." Not an accurate prediction, as I was to find out 2 days later. But we went down, and we, black and white folks, and we went into this Buddy's restaurant. They tore it down, the university did, when it should have been used as a civil rights museum. But they didn't want to do that.
Where was that, Paul?
What?
Where was Buddy's?
You know where that big swath of grass is? Down at the corner. Yeah, it was right there.
By the sports field?
It's right across from the motel there, the Cavalier Inn.
Yeah.
All that was there when we were there was a glass enclosed telephone booth. Anyway, we went into Buddy's restaurant. They had nice things to guide us, and they said, "Don't let our waitresses rush you." And they didn't. They spat on a few of us, but they didn't rush us. And we stayed through the evening. There were Christian epigraphs up all over the place, but they didn't. None of them seemed to be enforced that day. So they closed up. I mean, it time to go, and we went home. Well, the next day, or maybe it was the third day, we when there was a bouncer at the door making it clear that we couldn't come in. Three or four guys arrived, and they began making comments which indicated that they were not altogether pleased with our presence. And then they went in and got some more beer. I became very nervous at this point because Floyd, our leader, had asked me earlier to go get somebody to take his place because he was hungry and he wanted to go get lunch. So I went home, made telephone calls, and couldn't find anybody. So I went back and told him that, and he said, well, you be head of the line. I got to go eat. I said, well, okay, Floyd. And that was the first time a white person had been the head of the line. We had this line formed as though we were going into the restaurant, and there were a whole bunch of us in line. And so anyway, the guys came out. They had their beer or whatever they wanted, and they began pushing and shoving. And I said, oh, somebody ought to do something about this. And I said, oh, you head of the line. You're supposed to do something. So I walked across the street to this glass, you know what these telephone booths are like. And I went in, and I started to pull out the telephone book. Well, I didn't know what the number was at the police station. I had never called the police before. And I had my hand on the phone book, just had to pull out. When a substantial man, who I learned later had been a semi-professional prize fighter and weighed about 300 pounds, he put his arms on my shoulder and he lifted me out and he said, you ain't gonna call no damn police. And I didn't say, but I thought, you're absolutely right. Well, then he and his confederate was a very small guy, and he hit me a few times, but it was a very strange experience. I didn't hurt too much, but I was really interested in the experience. He'd never hit anybody before who didn't hit him back. Well, with this big man there, I wasn't going to hit him no matter how much nonviolence I'd been told. So I was nonviolent as this fella kept hitting me. And he just looked puzzled. His eyes were troubled. He'd never hit anybody, didn't hit back. So they took me back to the line, and some of the others who were there had called the police, and they identified the two men. They knew, of course, who they were. They had watched the whole thing anyway, so you could put that in your work. And I then went out to the Little League baseball field where I was assistant coach for my son's Little League team. And I'd been there about 20 minutes when a friend came out and said they'd issued a warrant for my arrest. And I said, what I've done? So anyway, I went to the jail. But I didn't get... I didn't have to stay in the jail. But what happened, the men's came back a little later and beat Floyd very badly. He had a bad back and stayed in the hospital 2 or 3 days. And William Johnson was beaten too. So we were the three who got beaten. And that was a big bit of publicity. And Floyd began getting telephone calls from restaurant directors, movie theaters, everybody. Don't come here. We're integrated. I was really surprised, but it was the violence that had scared them and made them think differently. And there was not a single major place in Charlottesville that remained segregated after this sit-in and their anxiety about what had happened. Now, there were lots of other factors, I'm sure, but we were all stunned by, Floyd was in particular, because he was the one getting the telephone calls. So we didn't have any sit-ins at these other places, at any of the motels or the restaurants or the hotels, and things changed. And I think there was another result. City Council changed. They appointed a committee on race relations. They were going to do something useful, we hope. And they did. And actually, the nature of Charlottesville leadership changed fairly soon. People like Francis Fife, I don't know if you all know him, became prominent in the city, became mayor pretty soon. And so a good number of good people came to leadership posts. Now, I don't think you could say that because there was a sit-in, because there was violence, because there was protest, this happened. But I think you can say that the places that stopped being segregated changed was a consequence of the sit-in and particularly the violence. So that's the end of this second half of my talk. I'll be glad to tell you what kind of bandages I wore. Or...
Could we ask a question or two?
Or three.
Do you know anything about, or can you point me to a source that could tell me anything about the if there were private schools founded in Charlottesville as a response to massive resistance?
Two of them.
Which are they?
Red Hill Academy.
Rock Hill.
What?
Rock Hill.
Rock Hill Academy. Mm-hmm. And Robert E. Lee must be that, the other one, the lower school. Rock Hill was the upper school, and Robert E. Lee was the... It was Robert E. Lee, wasn't it? Yeah. Did you go there?
I did not.
Okay. Yes, there was.
I came because I've been trying to catch up with you for about 50 years. Mm-hmm. I was here in the 60s doing nothing, I'm sorry to say, really, on these topics. I'm grateful that persons such as yourself did. It was my impression that there was quite a lot of crossover between various faculty and their spouses, both in the law school and the college, and some of these efforts to address the education gap mm-hmm. in Charlottesville during this time. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little about
that. I agree. No, what do you want me to say?
Refresh our memories, and for others of us, if you feel comfortable naming names, yeah. Tell us who those teachers were and where they were and what they were doing in this period of time when the schools were... actually, I wasn't here in the 50s, but when the schools were closing as a part of the massive resistance.
Oh, yeah.
And but others were stepping in to see that children had some learning
well,
to read.
In the summer before school closing, there was a lot of anxiety over what was going to happen. And the Venable mothers, you maybe remember this, or maybe not, the Venerable Mothers decided that they were on the side of open schools, but schools were going to be closed, so they had basement schools. There was a divide between them and the Rock Hill Robert E. Lee group, and who took children away. So there were two different areas for them. But I think one of my students has written a book called that's on this whole desegregation closing, Andy Lewis. I don't know, maybe this is off the subject, but it'll be interesting for teachers, directors of theses. Andy wrote a master's essay, that was his first piece on this, on the closing of the schools, the role of the emergency mothers, they were called, who were going to have schools in basements and churches and different places. Well, Andy wrote it, and he finished the first draft, and I said, you know, I think it'd be a good idea if you came over to my house and we invited the subjects of your master's essay to come too. So I invited all the women who had been in the sort of the group to save the schools, Venerable Mothers and others, and I had them read Andy's master's essay. So I guess he was having an exam by the people who were the subjects of his thesis, and they approved. So he got his M.A. And it's down here in Alderman if you want to go read it. I don't remember. Andrew Lewis. There's also a book, it's better, to go, that by Andy Lewis and Matt Lassiter. Lewis and Massiter. Lassiter. It's Matt Lassiter, not Massiter. And that is called The Moderate's Dilemma. And it has a summary of the thesis that Andy wrote, but a lot of other things about the school. It's the best book, because not many people write about Charlottesville, but it's the best book about the school problem that's been written when the schools were closed.
Any other questions?
Yes, sir.
I talked a little about the hospital before, and the way that the hospital was able to integrate is they tied reimbursement for patient care to integration. Was that something that happened at the university as well? The hospital didn't integrate because they thought it was a good progressive sort of thing. It was only when the stick and the carrot of federal money for reimbursement.
That I didn't know, happened. But you're talking about integration at the hospital means
integration. And I'm wondering if the same thing happened at the university, like Title VI. What was funding of the university somehow tied to integration that might have moved it along?
I don't think so, but I don't know. When you're talking about the hospital and integration, you mean black patients.
Yes, and for you quoted Colgate.
And nurses? Yeah.
Well, you quoted Colgate Darden here, who was against integration, but all of a sudden, when money was made available to build a new integrated hospital, he was the first to jump on the integration bandwagon. So money was kind of used at the hospital to lure people. And I wondered if a similar thing happened at the university.
I don't know. Sounds persuasive to me, but but I don't know. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, that's...
Did I tell you all about my visitor who came to my class? And he gave a lecture in my class. I didn't mention that. Okay. What he said was, thank you for having me, I'm a visitor, and I talk and you listen, and whoever finishes first just lifts his hand up. So, I guess.
May I ask just one simple, maybe final question? And it's, I've never really understood what the Southern Regional Council did. And I'd love to hear your explanation and of its rationale and mission.
Southern Regional Council was formally established in 1944. It was the successor to something called the Commission on Interracial something or other, which was established in 1919. And I'll forget about the Interracial Commission. Southern Regional Council was established in Atlanta, and its directors were black and white people of authority in their own professions as ministers or lawyers or professors. And once they got organized, they expanded so there would be a committee in Atlanta that did the work, and then there would be members all across the South. And it became the region's best and only, I guess that's, if you are the only one, you're the best one, organization in research, information, and advocacy. And in time, when Leslie Dunbar was the executive director, the council established the Voters Education Project, which became a very famous organization in the South for changing, for assuring the right to vote. A large sum of money came, and the Voter Education Project sent people out lobbying all over the South to get the right to vote. And John Lewis was head of it for a while. John was a longtime member of the SRC. I went down to the council not as a looking to be a regular member, but they wanted, well, the director, a guy named Paul Anthony, had wanted somebody who was a historian. I'm not sure why, because they should have been concerned more with the future than with the past. And Paul hired me, and I just thought it would be interesting to go down there for a year. And so I went, and I had the chair, the assignment of school integration, and I got to travel around the South and talk to schoolmasters and see what they were doing. And the council published a lot. Had a magazine, special reports, and came to be really the center of information on the civil rights movement in the South. Newspaper reporters, when they came South, would always come to the South, come to the SRC for information. And the SRC had a major influence on the newspapers. They come to the SRC. What was happening in Mississippi? Why did they burn this church in Alabama? And the SRC had its people out there and got all the answers to these questions. Unlike me, they could answer questions asked of them. And they had a brilliant series of executive directors.
I think it's so important because it speaks to the importance of research.
Absolutely.
Social movement.
Yeah. Well, the year I worked there, I wrote a couple of reports on school desegregation for the particular year that had just passed. But it theoretically exists today.
It does.
But I wrote to the director and said we ought to just arrange a wake because it's not doing anything worthwhile anymore. It's too bad.
Will you join me in thanking?